could I have your attention, please? My name is Isabel. I'm a debtor. And I have a role to play right at this minute that I'm extremely proud of. So I'd like to introduce to you, some of you may know him, our keynote dinner speaker for World Service Conference 2022 here in the UK. It's with great pleasure that I introduce you to Bill Dee, DA's General Service Board member. Could you give Bill Dee a hand?
Good evening, everybody. My name is Bill, and I am a debtor. And I want to welcome all the debtors here tonight, and the non-debtors, too. We have a few of those, and they are an integral part of our community. Before I came over here, my friend Chris M., who created something called the Tools Game, which some of you know about, Chris M. gave me a bit of advice. He said, just to ingratiate myself to everyone here in England, I should refer to everybody as governor. And I decided not to do that. And I think it's a good plan. It's worked very well. So I'm going to tell you a story tonight. And the story is about my life and how it relates to debting. So I was raised in small towns in the U.S., in Iowa and Texas. My mother and my father were both products of the Great Depression, the capital D that occurred all around the world, and I think there was also a little D of depression that was a very important part of their lives. And my mother, growing up during the 1930s, her family lost their homes several times because of the Depression. And I remember once hearing her and her brother, my uncle, talk about how many times they had to move in the different years. And my mother then became very afraid that there was never going to be enough money, that there just wasn't enough money. And when she came toward the end of her life, she had dementia. And she was terrified that they were going to lose their house. So she would say to my dad, well, what are we going to do if we lose the house? And he would try to explain to her that they couldn't because they owned the house. All the taxes were paid up, but she always felt that sense of impending doom. And when I was a little kid, she also, you know, she used to say things like, if you don't turn off the lights, we're going to go to, she didn't say the debtor's prison, the poorhouse, thank you, yeah. She said, we're going to go to the poorhouse. And I don't know if she believed in a Dickensian poorhouse, debtor's prison or not, but she definitely believed that there just wasn't enough money. She would say to me things like, you know, when I had my 50-cent allowance a week, she would say, if I spent something, that money's burning a hole in your pocket. If there was something that she needed to buy for me in high school, when she found out the price, she would say, well, that's higher than a cat's back. That's highway robbery. And I think my mom's idea of how much things should cost when I was in high school in the 1970s was maybe what they cost in 1939. So everything was always too much. And one of the things that my mother imprinted me with as well, she was a very angry person, and I became very afraid. I became afraid of everything and everyone, and that was my primary motivating emotion as I grew up. And she also used to tell me a lot when I would do something, she would say, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Shame on you. And I took that lesson in very deeply, and I manifested it for the first 30 years or so of my life. When I was in high school, I read a short story, and in this short story, a little boy is deeply affected because everything in the house, the people, the furniture, the walls, seem to be saying there must be more money. There's not enough money. And that was what I felt as well. If someone was really rich, my mother would say, well, who does she think she is? Lady Astor? I don't know who that was. And then if someone didn't have enough money or was on the public dole or welfare, she would say, well, there they go again, picking John Q. Public's pocket. So I kind of got the message that having a lot of money was bad, but not having enough money was bad. And I never was sure where that fine line was. And those are some of the ideas that affected me. One of the things that really affected me, too, when I was a kid was, you know, I was 11 or 12 years old. We lived in a small town. I would go to the movies by myself, and I asked my parents for 50 cents to go to the movie. It's a Jerry Lewis movie. Don't judge me for that. And they said, we don't have the money. They didn't have 50 cents, and I couldn't imagine how that could be possible. But then when I went into the other room, quite upset, my sister said to me, well, Mom and Dad are paying for my wedding, so don't ask them for any money. And I thought, well, you're working, and your fiancé is working. What the hell are they paying for your wedding for? So what I kind of learned was don't ask for money. And when I was in high school then, I went to, or my friends wanted me to go to them with a speech and drama workshop that happened in the summer. And I said, no, I can't do that. I can't ask my parents because they don't have that kind of money. And I think it was like $110 for 2 weeks, you know, room and board and everything. And they kept bothering me, and they kept bothering me about it. My friends did. And finally, I girded my loins, and I said to my parents, you know, my friends really want me to go to this, and I would like to go to it. And do you think you can pay for it? And they said, sure. And I thought, well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe there is some money. So I went to the workshop that summer, and I worked really hard, and I did a good job. And at the end of the workshop, the professors who ran it said, we would like to give you a scholarship to come back next year. So I was, you know, it was a big deal. I was awarded a scholarship, the one, so that I could come back the next summer. And of course, I felt proud, but my first thought, too, was, oh, that'll be good because Mom and Dad won't have to pay for it the next time that I go. So that was certainly a part of my thought process at all times. One of the things I also learned how to do sometimes was if my parents, if I had asked them a question about something, about money, or if they hadn't paid me my allowance, my 50 cents, I had a little porcelain bank that looked like a trash can, and my coins were in it. And I would go up to my room, and I would kind of rattle that bank, rattle the coins, and then hoping that they would hear it and then be reminded to talk about it. So I became, you know, kind of manipulative about money. Later on as an adult, you know, like I might have lunch with somebody and then talk about, well, you know, I really don't get paid very much. You know, my job just doesn't pay me that much. And then hoping, and this worked very often, that they would say, oh, here, let me buy lunch then. You know, so that was part of my difficulties with money. When I got into college, I heard about credit cards. I didn't know exactly what they were, but I knew enough to know that you could get something without having to pay for it. And so I became very desperate to have a credit card. I really wanted one. And so I applied for several, and I didn't get one because I had no credit history, and I became so angry. I felt like I was entitled to that credit card. Wasn't able to get one, though. And when I went to graduate school, I worked in a department of the school where people paid for their classes. And sometimes people would come up to the counter and they would say, oh, here's my credit card, and I would run it. And then they would, I would be told it was declined. So I'd have to go back and tell those people, sorry, your credit card is declined. And they became very, very angry. And they said, I just made a payment on that yesterday. It can't be declined. Run it again. And I would run it again, and, you know, it wouldn't happen. And I says, it's really sorry, but I still didn't know really how credit cards worked. I didn't know anything about what they call revolving credit. When I got out of graduate school, though, I was living in New York City. I had done what they call off-off-Broadway acting work, and that's usually the definition of off-off-Broadway is that there are more people on stage than there are in the audience. So if the audience decides to rush the stage, we could fend them off. So I went to grad school for a really great university. And when I finished my degree, my master's degree, my girlfriend at the time decided that she needed more money available to her. And she didn't have a degree, so the way that she decided more money could be available to her was for me to get a job in some profession where I would make more money. And at the time, I had, you know, very long hair. I didn't own any suits. I would wear like 3 earrings typically. So one day I went out and I got a suit and I cut my hair and pulled out the earrings and I went to employment agency and I got a job in a bank, one of the big banks, doesn't exist anymore. And eventually I started to work for that bank as a credit card marketing officer. So I was a communications officer, and I would write things. So, you know, like when you would go to get a cash advance on your credit card, they give you a little slip of paper. And I guess it was like the beginning of Twitter. We'd have like 140 characters or something to write a little message of why you should spend more on your credit card. And then I would write little articles and publish brochures that people would get in their credit card statement every month telling them, hey, here's a really cool place that you can spend something on your credit card. And that's what I did. And I want to backtrack a little bit, though, and say before I took that job, I finally did get a card. And it was one of those where you just pay it off. It's not a revolving card. You just pay everything at the end of the month. And I bought myself a nice black leather jacket and a silver and turquoise watch. And a friend of mine said, now, how are you going to pay for that? Like, what a question. What did it matter how I was going to pay for it? I have it now. Let the future take care of itself. And once I got into the banks, I got a couple of revolving credit cards, and the bank, my friends in the bank, were offering a credit card that had to deal with the university. You know, they called it, I can't remember what they called it, but it'll come back to me in a moment. But every time I use that card, they say, oh, it'll pay you like, pay 0.000002 cents to your university or whatever. And I said, oh, sure, I'll get it. And I'll just use it as an experiment to see how well their system works. You know, like that's what they wanted it to. You know, a couple months, it was up to the limit. All of my cards were up to the limit. And I can remember one particular rainy afternoon in New York City. I had an out-of-body experience, and it was lunchtime, and I was scuttling around the streets of Manhattan in the rain trying to find money because my credit cards were all maxed up. I had spent all the money from my paycheck, and I was going somewhere thinking I can use this card to buy traveler's checks or something, just to get through to the end of the month, and I didn't know how to do that. And, you know, there were times when I lived in New York that I didn't have subway fare. I would have to walk. I would borrow money from my bosses. At one time, I started trying to, like, sign in 10 minutes early so that they would, like, pay me whatever 10 minutes of the hour was. And I did all of these very desperate, manipulative kind of things. So I think my bottom was when I saw myself like that, scuttling around in the rain like a crab. because I felt like there must be more money. There must be more money. There isn't enough money. And something changed for me then. I had dinner with an old friend of mine from high school, and I was a mentor to her when we were kids, you know, in acting. And she had dinner with me in New York, and I told her, I said, I've got to get out of New York City. I'm dying here. But I don't have enough money. I don't have any money. I'm in debt, and I can't move. So 12 hours later, I was working for another bank. My boss came to me, and she said, I want to see you in my office. And she said, you don't seem like you're very happy here, you know, in this job. Would you take severance pay in order to leave? And I said, how much? And she said, 3 or 4 months. And I said, yes. And I went back to my desk, and I called my friend from the night before, and I said, guess what? I am getting out of here. And that's the first time in my life that I believed that there was a God who really cared about me. I grew up in churches in Texas and Iowa, and before that, I always kind of thought of God as being like the hand on the heater of the stove, controlling the temperature of the water that I was in. You know, like that God would just turn up the skillet on me, you know. I didn't believe that there was a God who loved me or who cared about me. And I started to believe it right then. So I moved from New York City to Austin, Texas, which had been my dream place to live ever since I was in high school. And I decided that everything was going to be good in Austin because, hey, it wasn't New York and I moved. And so I wrote my first rent check, and then I took too much money out of the ATM because I didn't have any clarity over what the balance was. And I came home one day and there was a sign in my apartment door that said insufficient funds, my check had bounced. My very first check in my great grand new perfect life. And I got into my car and I started driving, and a friend of mine in DA has referred to this as a DA blackout. I just started driving and I drove straight through a red light. And there was much honking and extension of fingers. No one got hurt. And I pulled up into a parking lot, and I just sat there and I cried. I didn't know what to do. But when I was leaving New York, a friend of mine had told me about a book that she really liked, and I picked up a copy of it. And in that book, which is a self-help book, the person in there said something. He said, everybody needs a 12-step program. Just pick one. That's what the person said. And I didn't know anything about 12-step programs. I knew there were 12 steps. I didn't know what they were. And I'd heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd heard about Overeaters Anonymous. And I think, well, neither of those applies to me. So, you know, whatever. So a few days after my near car crash, I was in a bookstore, as is my wont. And I saw a book whose cover spoke to me. And I opened the book, and I saw the words Debtors Anonymous in that book. And I said, I don't know what this thing is, but I need it. And because I wanted to save money, I got a copy of the book from the library. A couple of days later, I got an urgent call from my parents' neighbor. They lived about 6 hours away. My dad had gone into the hospital. My mother had dementia. They really needed help. And I got in the car and I just drove up there because I didn't have a job yet. My brother and sister were in Illinois. I could do it. I could help them. And about 2 or 3 months later, when I came back, that book was seriously overdue. And I went to the library. And I explained that to the clerk, and the clerk went off and talked to a supervisor. And they came back and said, it's fine. It's okay. You don't have to pay. And that was my first DA miracle. When I got to Austin on January 1st of 1991, I used a credit card for the last time. And I knew I had a problem with credit cards before I even heard about DA. So I stuck them in an envelope and I sealed it and I put it in the top shelf of my closet. And then a few days later, I told a friend of mine about it on the phone, and she said, well, I heard some guy say you should cut him up. And she said, you want to do that? And I said, heck yeah. I went downstairs, got the scissors, and I cut him up, and I threw him away. That was also before I'd heard of Debtors Anonymous, but from January 1st, 1991 until now, I have not accumulated or made any unsecured debt. When I came back from my parents, turned in the book, I bought a copy of it, and I started attending DA meetings. And, pardon me, I walked into my first DA meeting, and I waited until the very end, like, okay, it's over with, and I said, oh, there's no time for me to share, is there? And they said, yeah, go ahead and share, sure. Okay, so I shared, and I told them that I used to be a credit card marketer. And there were gasps. There was this, the sign of the cross, and everybody started laughing. And I really felt truly spiritually at home for the first time in my life. I'd always loved my theater groups, my college friends, but I felt welcomed and at home for the very first time. I started attending DA meetings. Thank you. And miracles began to happen to me. I went off on a little day trip and left my camera somewhere. And when I got back, I realized, oh my God, the camera's going to be gone. And it was, you know. But a couple days later, one of my friends I'd worked with in the bank called me up and said, can you do some work for me? I'll pay you X number of dollars. And that was just the amount of money for a new camera set. And I said, sure. So I did it. He paid me. I bought the new camera. I came back from the store. I had everything in a bag still. And I checked my email messages, and there was a message saying, yeah, this is a deputy sheriff down there in Bell County, and I think we got something that belongs to you. So it turned out that two young miscreants had taken my camera and took some pictures on Mother's Day, apparently, and then took it into a pawn shop. And I hadn't even unpacked the new camera yet. So I went and got it, and I had that money. One day I was reading, I was trying to look at some photographs, because I love photography, and there wasn't good enough light in my apartment. So I picked up the book that I had been, that I had bought, and the person who wrote the book talked about an incident where they needed something, and they talked to two of their friends, and their friends said, do you really need this? Yes. Do you have the money for it? Yes. And they said, go buy it. So I thought, do I have money for a really nice light? And I did. So I went out to a store, and I bought a really nice light so I could see my photographs. And the next day, I got a call asking me if I wanted to do a medical test. You know, I didn't have any insurance, and it was a medicine for asthma, which I have, and there was more money that came to me. My first PRG, I was scared to death. I lived in this beautiful apartment. Right across the street was a little convenience store, and two or three times a week I would go over there and get a chocolate chip cookie and coffee in the evening. And I was convinced that these two people were going to tell me, oh, you can't have that anymore. You know, you can't spend that money. And I told them about that, and they said, is that enough? Do you need more? Like, do you need to go every night? No. I think 3 or 4 nights a week is good. And they gave me an action plan, and we developed a spending plan. And during this time, I was still getting some calls from creditors. One guy called me back, I think, like 18 times in half an hour and screamed at me on the message machine. You know, he said, come on, act like an adult. Pay off your debts. One time when I picked up the phone, when I was still talking to him, I told the person, oh, yeah, well, I'm in Debtors Anonymous. And he said, well, Debtors Anonymous focuses on personal responsibility. Do you really think it's responsible of you to not pay your debts? So they had a script already. But I made it through all of those calls, and eventually I started paying off $10 a month. And eventually, over several years, I paid off enough that all my debts were done. That was probably 1997, 98, something like that. And one of the things that I haven't mentioned is that I am, my grandpa was a cowboy. You know, he was a stuntman in the movies. He was a horse trainer. There was nothing about horses that he didn't know. And I loved him. And I loved horses ever since I was a little kid. And my dad and his family were just wonderful country storytellers. You know, a lot of them didn't get past third or fourth grade, but they'd sit on the porch in the evening and just tell the stories. And sometime as an adult, it occurred to me that I wanted my own horse. And I thought, oh, I can't have that. That's too much money. One day, I started taking lessons, riding lessons. And one day, I showed up, and the owner of the stable said, I just bought some new horses. Maybe you'd be interested in riding one of them. And she introduced me to a horse named Rocky. It was love at first sight. And a few months later, I bought him. And he and I were best friends, boon companions for 10 years, until he passed away. When I moved to Austin, I told myself, I'm never going to leave this place. But I didn't know that about 10 or 11 years later, I would meet a woman who lived in Los Angeles and couldn't move to Austin. She's sitting right over there. And so my horse and I moved to California. Rocky and I, we took to it very quickly, and I started to go to meetings. When I lived in Texas, I didn't know that much about World Service. I just really didn't know. I knew there was like a place in Massachusetts and you send them money and they'd send you literature, but I didn't really know anything about that. And one of my dear friends, when I got to California, became my service sponsor, had been a former board chair. So I found out about World Service, and I eventually became, and I'd been doing service all along. I had been doing PRGs and treasurer and everything, but my home meeting, our GSR, passed away, and there was an election to replace her. So someone nominated me, and I accepted that position, and I served for 4 years. And then one day there was a meeting, like a kind of a workshop, where there were speakers about service, of whom I was one. And as I sat there, I thought, I think it's time for me to apply to the GSB. And I had kind of asked a few members before, GSB members, like, oh, is this like really hard? Is it a lot of work? And it's like, well, yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's worth it. And my service sponsor says, he says, I probably wouldn't do it again, but I would not have given anything for it. And being a member of the Board of Trustees has changed my life so much. This is my last year on the Board of Trustees, the end of my 6 years. And it has changed my life so much. What it has changed is that the promise that we've been seeing written everywhere has been given to me. That promise of a life of prosperity and serenity. That's what I have today. I'm not serene every single moment, but if I'm not, I know what to do to get there. I feel prosperous. This is my third trip to the UK. My very first trip was in the late 80s. I was working for the banks and, yeah, you know, put everything on the credit card and I need some more money, go to the cash advance, you know, get an ATM, cash advance, credit card, you know. That was part of the 10 or the money that I defaulted later on and then paid back. I eventually paid back that trip. I got a pair of cufflinks that were really beautiful. 5 years ago, I came to the UK and I went to a couple of meetings and I went to the Globe Theater. And I've got to tell you, I think of myself as a Shakespeare cowboy. I love Shakespeare. I love riding horses. And so at that 5 years when I came back, I wanted another pair of cufflinks, and they were at the Globe, but they weren't in my spending plan. So I didn't get them. Now I'm wearing them today because I got them on this trip. In my spending plan, I didn't debt. I haven't debted since January 1st of 1991. I used to feel like I was just not good enough. I was not good enough for anything. Today, I feel that I'm just right. I'm just the right person. A friend of mine, when I first got into recovery, an old high school friend ran into me. I told him I'm in a recovery program, and he says, "What are you recovering?" And I realized what I'm recovering is that person that I was meant to be before my life went askew. I am that person today. Being in 12-step programs makes me a better person, makes me a better husband, makes me a better father to my 3-step children. And my higher power is a guy named Will Rogers. Will Rogers, in the early 1900s, was a well-known actor and writer and cowboy. And I think of Will Rogers as the highest version of myself. And just got a couple more minutes here. I'm going to give you a little analogy, which some of you have heard, and if you have, that's fine. To me, doing service in DA is like being, even though this isn't a cowboy or Shakespeare metaphor, it's a good one, it's like being a sailor on a ship. And occasionally, you get to climb up to the crow's nest. And you look out over the water, you see the horizon, you see where you're going, you get a good idea of things, and then you climb back down and you start throwing ropes or doing whatever it is that sailors do. So you go up and you see it, and then you come down and you just keep working. So I'm going to leave you with a couple of quotations by my favorite writer, William Shakespeare. And the first one, when I say the word mercy, I want you to hear service. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It's twice blessed. It blesses him that gives it and him that takes. When we do service, we bless ourselves and we bless other people. And then the final thing, another quotation by my favorite writer, says, "This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man." But being true to myself, I can't be false to anybody else. So I thank you.